Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Really?
Hey, Jim.
Wow. Wait a minute. There we go.
There we go.
Oh, my God. Today must be Thursday.
Hey,
this is Belgium.
We got a new clock on the wall.
We have a new clock. We just need new people in the studio now. We're going to be just fine. Hey, this is another Thursday evening. You are listening to LA Talk Radio. And this, of course, is The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christina. I am your host in the studio tonight with Bobby Jean Bell.
And back.
Who's finally back with me for another week or three. And then she's gone again. So. But we love her. I'd really miss her when she's not here. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Jim. It's great to be here.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good to have you back in the studio. You know,
Thank
we miss you.
You
when you're not here.
Well, I enjoy listening to the podcasts, and you just don't ever want to miss a show, whether you're in this seat or you're out in listener land. You don't want to miss it.
That is absolutely true. That's absolutely true. So... I got a couple announcements. Of course, Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley. The nice folks at Black Dog, they can help you walk you through the trials and tribulations of doing your own publishing, or indie publishing as we call it here in the Writer's Block. Their number there is 805-795-3165. And of course, by Out West, your source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and the Western lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. National brands include Scully Leather, Rockamont Ranch Wear, Dan Post Boots, and American West Handbags. And do they have somebody who teaches speech impediment?
We do.
Okay, then. Well, we're good to go. And that number there is 877-340-9378, or you can write them on the web at scvoutwest.com. And that, of course, is Miss Bell and Mr. Bell sitting here in the studio with me tonight. And, of course, our wonderful friends at Target Freight Management. Since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. Ooh, I'm moving my mic. They go to great lengths to secure them. We're going to just, like, this is going to be an insane evening.
It's live radio.
I know, huh? Live radio. I gotta love live radio. Most competitive rates possible. TFM also provides unmatched customer support for our dedicated truckload division. In an effort to streamline their customers' overall shipping efficiency, TFM provides real-time updates on all lanes. Call TFM today at 844-653-7789 and tell them you heard it here in the Writer's Block. They'll have a little something extra for you. And if you are an LTL shipper, I'm in great voice tonight.
Mm-hmm.
LTL shipper, we know you are looking for the best rates with the least hassle. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just a ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. For both truckload and LTL, you will not be disappointed. I guarantee you won't be. Okay, announcement coming up June 17th. Me, the host, Jim Christina, I have a book signing event coming up at the $5 or less bookstore in Simi Valley. It'll be June 17th from 10 to 2. We're going to try to stretch it, or 10 to 12. We're going to try to stretch it 10 to 2. So we're going to be having a book signing, and then we're going to be having a lively discussion on writing and publishing and all kinds of stuff in our neighborhoods.
How cool.
In our
is that a Saturday? What
community.
Day?
It is a Saturday.
It's a Saturday.
Yeah.
Mm.
Richard will be there with me, and he's going to, he says, can I bring the book? I said, yeah. No, this is my.
We enjoyed having him with us at the bookshop. At the Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival. It was really fun.
Richard is a really good guy. We had dinner with him, he and his wife, last Saturday, and of course he filled in last Thursday for Bobby, and it's just been 2 years.
I can't believe it's 2 years.
Two years, huh?
Wow.
Yeah, we've been on there 2 years.
We've read a lot of books, Jim.
I know, huh? And they, you know, they keep getting thicker. I'm gonna have to bring that up to our author tonight. Can I have her bio that you stole from me?
Yes, I will pass this right over to you.
I actually made a road trip. That's what us retired people can do. We would take road trips. And I went down to Del Mar to a place I used to work at when I was a kid. It used to be called the Fire Pit. It's now called Poseidon's. And had lunch with tonight's author. And tonight's author is, she's published in numerous literary and legal magazines and holds a PhD in I didn't even know that. And I should have. I would have felt a whole lot more stupid sitting in front of her at lunch than I did. In literature from UC San Diego, where she taught for many years, she speaks nationwide on the topic of literature and the law. A California Bar Association accredited course and a credential. Somebody bring a flask next week, would you? A credentialed mediator. Her three historical mysteries have garnered several awards, including finalist status in the 2009 California Commonwealth Book Club Awards for the Natural Selection, finalist status in the 2015 Los Angeles Book Awards for Rule of Capture, and a 2015 IPPI Silver Medal for Regional Fiction for Rule of Capture. Would you please welcome to the Writer's Block, Ms. Ona Russell. Ona, you with us?
I'm there. I'm here.
Wait a minute.
I'm everywhere.
I have to give you the clap. Hold on.
Okay.
You know, there's not that many of them, but they can clap real loud.
I like that.
How you doing?
That's fun.
Oh, it was so great having lunch with you the other day.
Oh, I love that. That was a great lunch, and not to mention that the food was delicious.
It was.
And the company was stimulating.
Yes,
and
you were.
The view was magnificent.
Oh, well, gee, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, well, it was a nice drive, and I had a good time coming down, especially in the doom and gloom of Southern California this time of the year.
Yeah, but it was so interesting hearing about your own history here. You know,
well, yeah, I actually do have a history there, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
Jim has history everywhere.
I do.
Is what we learn on this show, because no matter who our guest is, he has a historical connection.
He's been there?
Yeah.
Well, not always, but a lot of the time, because I've traveled a lot.
Yeah.
So I mean,
yeah. Well, that makes it all the more interesting.
Well, it does, and you know, Bobby says, "Wow, you know, is there any place you haven't been?" There's lots of places I haven't been, and lots of things.
We don't book guests that ever have been to those places.
I know, huh? They're always like places right. I've been.
Well, maybe my son lived in Bogota, Colombia. How about that?
I've never been to South America.
You know, if you ask him two or three more open-ended questions, though, you will find a connection.
Maybe.
Yep.
Well, you know,
six degrees.
Uh-huh. I was just going to say, Ona, 6 degrees.
Yep.
Anyway, I actually gave Ona a book. I did.
Oh, you did?
I did.
And I absolutely loved the first paragraph. Oh. And I am reading it.
Oh, good for you.
But yes, the watch felt heavy in his hand.
Yeah.
That line is mm-hmm. a tremendous line. That says so much in that one line.
Well, it's world weary, Caleb Stringfield.
Yes. It's a great opening line. I may steal it for my next book.
Well, ask me first, would you? That is copywritten material.
Yes.
I you know, we discussed briefly at lunch, but I really, your character, Sarah Kaufman, she's quite the lady, and I really liked her a lot.
No, I'm glad you like her. That's all I was going to say.
Oh, I do like her, and I love this story. But then I know that story, most of it, other than the fictitious parts about traveling down in Mexico and blah 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 blah. That trial actually took place. Those couple of murders actually took place. There's you defined and described old L.A. to a T.
Thank you.
We're talking about your book, Rule of Capture, just
we
in
are.
Case our
oh yes
our listeners.
Yes, oh yeah,
which is the third book that Sarah Kaufman is the major character
Correct.
For, and I must tell you, I finished reading this book at about 4:15 this afternoon.
Oh my God.
I started it only a couple of days ago and couldn't put it down. As Jim was saying,
oh, wow.
part of its enjoyment is the depth of historical description that you give us, especially those of us that live in LA that maybe are not natives here. I have always wondered, like, why is it called Wilshire Boulevard? Or you set this book in 1928. What is it about this time period that captured your imagination for this book?
Well, all of the books are set in the 20s, and that came out of the original book because the information that I got that led to that book was set in the 1920s. And so when I taught at UCSD and when I did my doctoral research, I was working in the 19th century. So I was already interested in the past, and I was used to doing archival work and that sort of thing. So when I came upon, actually these were, very briefly, these were scrapbooks from my husband's family about his grandfather, who was a prominent judge in Toledo, Ohio in the 1920s. And these scrapbooks were about his life. And those books, actually, those scrapbooks led to the first novel, and they led to my discovery of Sarah Kaufman, who was a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And so those scrapbooks were situated, all the stories or the news clippings that were in those scrapbooks were 1920s, from the 1920s. And so I became interested in them in that period because of the material. But then, because the period was so inherently interesting, I stayed there, and mm-hmm. I decided to write all of my all the books in the series in the 20s, because it has, you know, in addition to having so many of the things we associate with the 20s, like flappers and prohibition and those sorts of things, there's also this undercurrent of racism and cultural clash, and a lot of the sorts of immigrant concerns about immigrants, a lot of the same things that we experience today.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this real correlation with contemporary life mm-hmm. and that historical period. It's a very, very rich period. So that really is why I became interested in that particular period.
Yeah, it truly is. And you're taking Sarah out to Boyle Heights
mm-hmm. yeah.
to a shoe store.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
they actually had family-owned shoe stores back then. And they either sold or made the shoes on premise, which I just thought was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was actually my grandfather's. That was based on my grandfather's shoe store in Boyle Heights.
Is that? Oh, yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah, Cantor's, right?
Very cool.
Oh yes, Cantor's.
Yeah.
And actually, ironically, it was in those days, you know, before Cantor's, the deli moved to Fairfax. It used to be right next door to my grandfather's shoe store. So there was Cantor's. Canters,
right,
which
right.
was the deli, and then there was my grandfather, Kantors. Now, the really interesting thing about that is that in my research for this book, I went back to Boyle Heights and traced, you know, went through the neighborhood. Obviously, it's changed now. It's mainly Hispanic, but then it was this melting pot of different cultures, mm-hmm. a lot of Jewish people, and I went back to the address where his shoe store was,
mm-hmm.
and in that same spot is a shoe store.
Oh,
but now
how
it's
cool.
owned by a Latino family.
How wonderful. When you went back to Boyle Heights, did you go armed? I have to ask, because I would.
Actually, you know, it wasn't all that safe back in my dad's day either.
Oh, I'm sure.
He kind of belonged to he turned out to be a doctor, but he was pretty rough back then.
Uh-huh.
So it's always had a kind of, you know, a little bit of an edgy quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it really was just fine. Mm-hmm. And I met these wonderful people who owned this shoe store. And it was this kind of really interesting moment of meeting people who occupied the same space as my grandfather did.
That's
fascinating.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, and I know Crescent Street is the street that the Bradford home is on, right? Is that Crescent
yes.
Avenue, Crescent
yes.
Street? And the other day, we just happened to find ourselves down on Wilshire. We were going to the Peterson Automotive Museum, and I kind of remember that we crossed over onto Crescent, and I thought as I was reading the book, like, oh my gosh, we don't find ourselves in that part of town all that often, but we were just on that street.
Well, Well, I tried, you know, as a writer of historicals, you know, the goal is to make that the context, the historical context, as authentic as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you're telling a you know, your plot is fictional, the supporting details, you know, for me are everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get them right, you know, your readers of historicals are going to call you on it. And
oh, absolutely, especially if they know LA or wherever. Yeah,
I had one of my characters is smoking, and there's a Lucky Strike, and Lucky Strikes were smoked in the 1920s.
Absolutely.
Yeah. However, I didn't do my research quite as well as I should have, because I said the packet was the package was red and white, and I had a reader say not back then, green and white. So I screwed up, and they'll tell you, you know. So anyway, the historical details to me are very important.
Well, and I think, and we've read a number of books in historical fiction genre, and I think the thing that amazes me at a writer's talent is to bring in all of the richness of the detail, but not have us as readers feel like we're reading Wikipedia or something.
Yeah.
Even though you give us some facts of, you know, like the Wilshire Boulevard story, originally it was 35 acres, and it's already been 30 years since he had bought it to the time that we're in the book. But you give it to us in a capsule, so we go, oh, wow, that's so interesting. But we're not feeling like, oh, that's a fact that just has been thrown on the page, you know, that it's giving us the context. And
that's one of the hardest things, you know, as a writer of historicals is knowing when to pull back,
mm-hmm.
knowing when not to be didactic, you know, to not be preachy. Because for me, and for most writers of this genre, we are so fascinated by every detail of history, and we think, oh, we got to include that. But what happens is what you're pointing out is that if you encounter it just like a fact, you're pulled out of the narrative,
mm-hmm.
and then you lose the flow of the story. So a lot of it involves pacing and how much to include and how much not to include.
Right,
and
right.
You know, what details are really relevant.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that Sarah carried a flask around with her.
Oh, I know that you give them
as
such.
So many people did back then, because, of course, alcohol was illegal.
Only back then?
Well, no. But, I mean, alcohol was illegal, so almost everybody had
a
flask.
Right, so, yeah.
You didn't see mine at lunch there?
No, I wasn't paying attention to your flask.
So what
she carried a flask, and she's not the kind of, in the first book she's not a drinker, but over time things happen to her, and she, you know, she becomes a little bit more
jaded.
I don't know. Yep. Yeah, she needs help getting through life.
Yeah, know? Well, don't we all?
Exactly.
What do you find are challenges to take an actual event like the trial? She comes here to witness a very important trial that's going on. You have a real character, Sarah Kaufman, coming from Toledo. You're putting her in a situation that is a real situation. What are some of the challenges of taking reality and putting fictional layers on it, if that's a right way to phrase that question?
Right, no, that's a very good way to put it. They're huge. There's a lot of challenges. I mean, you have to decide what you're trying to do in the book. Because you're calling it historical fiction, clearly you have more license than if you were to just write a straight history. But you're also trying to reveal something about that historical moment that is real and truthful, but that you're telling through a fictional prism. So so a lot of it is just trying to be as credible as possible and linking things in a way that makes sense and that is a convincing, you know, has a convincing plot,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to just throw in these details just to throw them in.
Sure.
With the standpoint of this trial, which was, this was the trial of this person, his name was Courtney Chauncey Julian, C.C. Julian for short, and he would call me C.C. He was a huckster, you know, and in And in the early part of the century, of course, there were, you know, oil fields all over Los Angeles and oil wells. And he was one of these guys that tried to, you know, get people to invest. He had a couple of oil fields and he wanted people to invest in his oil, And he was, he really wanted to represent himself as the common, you know, targeting the common man. He was a man of the people. You didn't need to invest in Standard Oil and some of these, you know, the Big Five or whatever they were. You could just invest in this well and you could make a fortune. And so what he did was ultimately, initially, actually, the stocks did do well for some people, but then he oversold and swindled thousands and thousands of people out of a lot of money. He was really the Madoff of you know, of Los Angeles, and people killed themselves over this. This was prior to the
crash in 1929. Yeah,
a year before
prior to the crash. And people had invested in oil crazy, like crazy, and they, many people made money, but a lot of people lost money. And so this trial, which really did occur over the course of a couple of years, was about this stock scandal. And so I have my character, Sarah Kaufman, and here's where, you know, here's where history, here's where fact and fiction, where the challenges of bringing them together. Sarah was a real woman in 1920s, but I made her into a fictional sleuth, right? So she's predicated on a real woman, but she's my fictional sleuth. And she comes to this trial that was a real trial, but my plot is that she's invested in stock and she lost money and is coming to see the trial because he wants to see justice being done. So those are the ways that I kind of, you know, play with truth and fiction. But my goal really is to tell, is to use fiction to reveal certain truths, if that makes sense. Truths about human nature, truths about, you know, how people interact with one another, and using a, using a historical backdrop to tell a, to present a kind of fictional plot that's woven, that has elements of truth woven throughout it.
Right. You used a couple of props in your book that that old Los Angeles had that are no longer in old Los Angeles, and that's the streetcars. And actually, some of the streets down in L.A. still have the streetcar tracks down the middle of them. But I was it was amazed because even Wilshire Boulevard had a streetcar that went down, but then when the Wilshire Boulevard stopped, it was all dirt.
My dad, who is 89, he was able to provide me with some details, even though he was a, you know, he wasn't even born in the, in he was born in 1927, so he was, you know, he was 1 year old, but he was able to tell me things about the streetcars, which were, which went on, you know, for at least into the 30s.
Yeah, because there were the red cars and the orange cars.
They had, they had several of the different lines, and some of them were horse-drawn and some of them were electric. So, I mean, L.A. still had horse-drawn streetcars back in the 1920s.
And some got you around,
and I
like, locally, and some
I had a lot of fun going to all these landmarks, you know, like Grauman's, Chinese.
I loved what you wrote when you, in fact, the drive down here, I was reading aloud to my husband, the other Jim in the room, aloud about Wilshire and then about Grauman's Theater and the background, because I didn't know he had built the two others, the, the million dollar, the Egyptian and the $18 million
He built the three theme theaters.
Again, you know, connected to the Klondike, his dad connected to the Klondike. And him performing, making his money initially from performing during the Klondike. So interesting.
And I think one of the ways you can, you know, there is a case where, you know, you could get, you know, too, you could inundate your readers too much with all of these details, but I'm having my character, who's never seen these things, experience them and see them for the first time. And so in that way, I'm hoping anyway that readers experience it the way that she experienced it. And so that it doesn't become like, oh, you know, here's the Grauman's and here's this and here's that, but it's just the way that she's encountering the city, you know.
Well, and I think that's, I think that's really important. Even though we are living here in Los Angeles, lots of readers won't be living in Los Angeles, but the Brown Derby and some of these other places could be an icon that you think in your mind, but you've never been there. So, and you know, and we're fast losing some of these places as well. You write about a time, I think, of Los Angeles history, and you write about the citrus industry, you write about oil, and you touch on film, and those were certainly three very important businesses into the history of Los Angeles. And I never really think of them all kind of course, happening all at the same time, and all of the different types of people that are involved in each one of those industries, and you bring them all together.
Right. But then you also had big, huge agriculture.
Exactly. The whole agricultural piece.
I mean, the big four were right there.
Exactly. And, you know, to think of those two, you know, like oil wells and oranges, which is, you know, the cover of my book.
Which were right together.
Right together.
Which really was, you know, was California, was Southern California. I mean, that was very iconic. Those oil wells, especially. And, you know, and then the citrus industry, and of course, that's still being, you know, a large industry that we have today. It's interesting to me to see which ones of these things have continued on to this day, what sorts of, you know, things have happened with the politics surrounding them. You know, you think about where oil is today, what happened in, you know, in the years following the where the novel is set, what happened with, for example, Cesar Chavez and, you know, the pickers and the unions and all of those things that started in the 20s, which, and that form some of my novel.
Which you, I was just going to say, which you bring up, and you begin that whole. The whole scenario with Carlos.
Yes, and then, of course, let's not forget water.
Oh, yeah.
and water.
And we live out in the Santa Clarita area, so the St. Francis Dam, which you touch on briefly. Again, some of these things is like, okay, there's Mulholland mentioned in this sentence, but, you know, it's tantalizing for those who are reading and maybe think, I never heard about a dam. Like, what's that about? And would want to maybe now go and investigate that. You give us a wealth of things to want to go learn more about.
That's
great. I mean, that's as good as, if that happens, then I've accomplished something very
important. If that was your goal, you made it.
I mean, it's a, you know, the task is multi-layered, you know, because you're wanting to just tell a good story. You know, you're wanting to you know, you're wanting to, it's the mystery, so you got to solve the mystery.
Sure.
And, you know, you got to have the, you know, all of the other supporting details are, should be intriguing, but you still got to move that plot along. And, you know, and then the plot itself, of course, is related to things that were real as well. So, for example, without giving too much away, what happens in the Mexican Quarter that leads to speculation about the cause of the murders was real. There was, and I'll just say it, you know, there was a plague in Los Angeles in the 1920s that was confined, but that had a lot of involvement from the city, because the city in those days, you know, they were trying to import people to Los Angeles.
Right, they were trying to keep the plague quiet.
Because Los Angeles was the place of healing.
Sure,
you know, California. Come to California, you know, where you're going to get
state.
You're going to get
blue
revived,
sky.
You know,
right,
fresh
sun.
Fruit.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a question for you, Ona. How do you establish credibility with your reading audience? You being a 2017 author writing about 1928, and that's got to be a little bit on your mind as you're penning this book.
Yeah, and I think it certainly is. I'll tell you, you know, Henry James, the you know, 19th century author, famous author, he had this real thing against historical fiction. He Sir Walter Scott was said to be the first wrote the first American or the first historical fiction. That's what Henry James used him as his sort of model anyway. And he said that historical fiction, he hated it. He hated it because he said it was impossible to capture the consciousness of another period.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you can write about all these details and everything, but you can't capture the essence of it, the consciousness, as he put it. And I think that's true on some level, but what you do to try to be credible is to get as much of that as you possibly can. And that's to do your research fully. For example, when researching the trial, I went to the Los Angeles Law Library and did a lot of research there and got court dockets and the testimony from the trial. And to establish a kind of credibility, mm-hmm. I wove in real testimony from the trial.
Mm-hmm.
All the testimony that I include is actual testimony
right.
from the trial. So that, some people have read a couple of those from those testimonies and said, God, did they really say that? And I say, yeah, they really said that. So credibility, I think, is established through various means, through doing your research, through getting the details right, but also through telling a plausible plot,
mm-hmm.
Having something that makes sense and mm-hmm. that the connections work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you just do it. I think book by book, you establish credibility to prove yourself that you are in fact. And the PhD doesn't hurt.
I wasn't going to mention that. Had I known you were a PhD when I had lunch with you, I probably would have had a better food than I did.
Yeah, so, that gives me some credibility.
Sure.
Actually, in fact, the PhD, I would say for me, that's been the primary thing that it's done,
mm-hmm.
is that it's given me credibility as a writer, because I've taught and I've done a variety of things, but I never really wanted to see myself as an academic. I really am not. I just am not an academic at heart, but it has helped me in knowing how to do research, learning how to do research, knowing, what potential pitfalls there are, what the pleasures of it and what the perils are,
mm-hmm.
Of trying to present yourself as a credible historical fiction writer.
Sure. Hey, let me take a second here and give out the phone number here in case there is anyone out there that wants to call in and talk to you. The number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. And you can call in and talk to Ona Russell, who is just a terrific lady. And she's written some wonderful books, historical fiction.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? I'm always curious about the naming of a book. So this is titled Rule of Capture.
Right.
Did you have that title initially? Did it come to you as you were working on it? And why title it that?
It was actually based on something about oil rights, that the idea was, or the under law, is that it initially involved water rights, and then it was extended to oil rights, that if you have, like, say you have a neighbor who discovers oil on their property, and that oil seeps into the other neighbor's yard. Now, I'm giving this kind of a weird example, but you get the point. That neighbor has the right to claim that oil or capture it, okay? That's the rule of capture. It involves the ability for one person to capture the water or the oil that seems to belong to the person whose property it's on, but that's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the title came from, but that title, even though it applies to oil and water, metaphorically, I thought it would work well as a metaphor for what else happens in the book. So if you think about, if you've read the book, you see what happens to, or the motivation for the murder.
Right.
Involves, what belongs to one person, that person is going to claim that for themselves.
Well,
so
that,
it involves ownership. It involves ownership of property, ownership of a person. That's how I use it metaphorically.
Right.
So I thought it would work well as both a literal title that involved, some of the literal things that are going on in the book, but also the metaphorical things.
Sure.
Yeah. The main character, one of the main characters, Carlos Martinez, says, whoever gets to the resource first has the rights to it.
His whole deal was really surprising for me, because as it turned out, everything he was doing was not for him.
Mm-hmm. He's a lot of complexity to Carlos.
We're not going to go real deep into Carlos, because you really need to read the book to find out about him. But you find out that what he's done is not.
And were you surprised, Jim, at the? We do have some murders that take place. Were you surprised when we don't want to say how that all resolves itself, but did you anticipate?
No, I did not. And congratulations, Oni, you got me on that one.
Did that surprise you?
It totally got me. Totally.
But the question is, did it make sense?
Yes, in the fact that we had a young man who was trying to emulate his elder. I think that's where it made most sense to me. But it was almost like you did it as a second thought, but it worked.
Yeah, it came out a little of left field, but just if you like to watch detective shows, you're coming to an hour and, it needs to be resolved. And you kind of go like, okay, there were these seven characters in this show, and we know the detective didn't do it. So you start to kind of eliminate. And I began to kind of do that. And I had an inkling. And I kept saying, no, could it be? No.
Well, you don't really meet the perpetrator until later on in the book. So
how it was revealed and all, it was like, oh my God,
And then you go, oh, and then you go, oh my God.
This is another challenge, right, of being a mystery writer, being a historical mystery, and that's, dropping the clues while simultaneously, shifting away from those clues.
Right.
So you want to drop them, but you also don't want the reader to linger on them too much, because then it's going to ruin it for them.
You have to shift their focus away from it.
And that's why I just had to keep reading this afternoon, and I was really wanting to prepare for great questions for tonight, but I was like, okay, I got 40 pages. I have to know.
I got to know.
I don't just want to skim the pages to, find it. It's like, no, I don't want to miss anything, because she's so detailed. I got to, have it all.
And because, again, if you look at the quotes that begin, the novel, I have two quotes that begin the novel, and one is from Octavio Paz and the other one is from Emma Goldman, and those quotes actually also kind of speak to the novel, speak to the crimes that occur. So I have Emma Goldman's "Poor human nature, what horrible crimes have been committed in thy name?" And it is about human nature. The book is about, and some of the most basic things in human nature, the things that we tend to overlook, but the things that really
are common to all of us, regardless of our heritage.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
And that's also, isn't it, that's also what a good book should do, is be specific to the individual characters that you've drawn, but also have it speak to larger human issues.
Mm-hmm.
if it's not universal in some way, then it's only going to, you know, reach a certain readership, and you're not going to get the wider audience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think everything has to be kind of both specific and universal.
Here comes the question.
Here comes the
question.
The clock on the wall is 7:40. Here comes the question.
Here comes the question.
Okay. Uh-oh.
The name of this program is The Writer's Block. Have you ever had writer's block?
Yes, I have. And I will tell you that I've had it recently. You know, with writing mysteries, I don't know that writer's block is as much of a problem writing a mystery. The only block that I had when I'm trying to plot it out is, you know, figuring out the connections and can I make this work and is this too far of a reach and that sort of thing. And the mystery part of it is actually like a puzzle. And it can block you, but it's not really, you're not blocked in writing as much as you are in figuring something out, mm-hmm. figuring out a puzzle. What happened to me recently is I'm writing a book right now that is not a mystery. And I was telling you, Jim, that this comes out of one of the characters of this book,
right.
Rule of Capture. I felt that I wanted to tell his story, but I didn't want to tell it in the mystery form, so I'm attempting this is my first attempt at literary fiction, and it's his story as an adult, because he's a younger man in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been writing it and writing it and writing it. I'm about 150 pages into it, and suddenly I could not go forward. I could not write. I was having a major crisis about well, I'll tell you, the character, as I told you, Jim, is a male,
mm-hmm.
and he's Hispanic, and I'm writing first person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm writing. This is my first of all. These other books are in third person.
Right.
I'm writing first person. I'm writing first person male Hispanic.
That'll kill you, you know.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of reasons why if somebody might say to me, why are you doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I didn't really think about why I was doing it when I started writing. I just felt like I had to write this man's story, and
mm-hmm.
this seemed the best way. The first person seemed like the best way to go. Well, halfway into it, I suddenly start wondering about what I can actually say about a Hispanic male. Like, where am I getting this? You know, what, I mean, I have some Latinos in my family and, you know, so forth, but I don't know the experience of this person that I'm claiming to know this experience of, and all of a sudden I'm writing in this male voice, and it's very weird. And I started doubting myself and started questioning whether I should shift the whole thing mm-hmm. into a female voice, change the whole story. And I actually stopped writing. I could not write. And I'm in a writer's group, which has been enormously helpful to me. And I had, like, I had an emergency call, and it's like, seriously, really feeling, because I had a couple of reasons. One is this whole idea of what can I possibly say? The other one is rather mercenary. And that is, or it involves commercial, the commercial aspects, because I don't know if you're aware, you probably are, obviously you're aware, that there's this whole idea now from many people in literary circles that the only people that can write about a certain group is the group themselves,
the group itself.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing writing about, you know, what are you as a white Jewish woman, what can you possibly say about a, you know, mm-hmm. Hispanic male? You don't mm-hmm. have the right to write about that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole, and I'm thinking, who's going to buy this? Who's going to even want to see this? And so I had commercial concerns, and I had more personal concerns. And so I just was completely, I just stopped writing. I couldn't think of how I'm going to go on, and I got so depressed about it. Now I'm I'm moving forward with it. And I've kept the character.
Good.
Because I've decided that if it doesn't work commercially, it doesn't work commercially. I have to tell his story, mm-hmm. and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it my way. But it was a very, very long, very difficult process for me, and that's when I was blocked.
Well, you know, Ona, I think the gratification sometimes, not always, but sometimes is just finishing the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Getting the story told.
Yes.
You know, and if it doesn't sell, it doesn't sell. But, you know, at that point, you've worked so hard on it that, you know, now you know you're finished with it.
Yes.
Well, and I think...
And, you know, I know that lots of people have a lot of, you know, manuscripts in their desks.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, that have either been unfinished or finished or but have never been published and all of that. I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But
you're gonna. You're a writer.
This may be the book that I need to do this in, and whatever the outcome is it's something. And I feel like I'm being challenged much more in this book, and my writing has deepened, and so there's many reasons to keep going with it.
Excellent.
I think that's a kind of a dilemma that the creative spirit, all of you with creative spirits, you walk that line. I hear it from, you know, artists who will say, I have to. Paint this. I have, whether it sells or not, the spirit, you know, I need to do this.
Right.
And there's that fine line. I was on a staff at a museum for years, and we would discuss exhibitions, and sometimes, you know, grants would come back and they'd say, well, you need to do this and this and this and this in order to have us go forward with grant money. And we would, the committee would say, well, but is that the story, you know? So I think that's an ongoing, it has to be an ongoing line.
Yes.
And I'm glad that you kind of bring it up, because to those listening that maybe are writers that listen to the show, that has to be a line that you often struggle with, or a question that you often struggle with in the creative process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I handle that?
Yeah, and I think it really is, so much depends on why you're writing and what your constraints are, what your financial situation is, you know, so many things. Some, you know, if you have the privilege of writing without having to make a living at it,
mm-hmm.
You feel like you have more freedom to explore like that. But there are writers who, you know, are just getting by through their writing, and they don't have the same sort of the same sort of privilege to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There are others who would rather just be struggling and poor, but they have to get their writing done. You know, mm-hmm. there's all levels of writers. I think this was one thing I learned. I went to a conference up in San Francisco, and not learned, but it really felt right to me. This very well-known author got up and said, you know, there are all kinds of writers. Don't say, well, I'm not that writer, so I'm not a writer.
Mm-hmm.
There
mm-hmm.
are all kinds of writers. And I think that you just have to follow the road you're on as much as possible and, see what happens, basically. You know, it's a journey. Itself, the writing is a journey itself.
Most mm-hmm. certainly is, mm-hmm. and with that, we're going to have to kind of close the show down.
Okay.
So, if you wouldn't mind, give us your contact information, email, Facebook,
website.
I am on Facebook. You can find me at, just Ona Russell. Look me up. I'm on Facebook, and my website is onarussell.com. And email onarussell@gmail.com. And I guess that's the contact.
Excellent. Though. Excellent. Well, thank you
so
much for joining us.
Fun to have you with us.
Thank you. I loved it.
I sent you a mug before, didn't I?
Very good questions.
Did I send you a coffee cup before?
No. Oh, yes, you did. Yes, you did. I have a coffee cup. Yes, I do. Yes. I do.
Take you to lunch. What do I get? I'm sorry?
I'm a fiction writer,
Oh, yeah, I hear you. Ona, thank you so much for spending an hour with us or 50 minutes with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful having you. And stay in touch. If you ever want to call us back, you got a new project coming, feel free.
And put it on the Writer's Block Facebook page,
there
too,
you go.
Please.
Yes, I will.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye.
Right, bye-bye.
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 Ona Russell. Great lady, huh?
Yeah, I was happy to finish the book. Because now I have to start reading for next week.
Well, next week we have Elliot Parker.
Have you already read
it? I have not started an Elliot
book yet.
Yes, I'm
going to start that tonight.
I will probably start it this weekend. It's not a real big book. So,
oh, no? Well, no. Still takes me time.
Well, I don't have that worry anymore.
I know,
I don't do the 10 hours a day.
I have cracks of time. And
And the following week, we have Peggy Wheeler.
Right.
She's back with us, so that's always fun. And then we have a couple people that are going to be with us off in the future a little bit. We have Craig Johnson coming back from Longmire. Mm-hmm. We have, of course, the twins will be in, Heisner. Mm-hmm. And
I see Gary Phillips is back on the schedule.
Gary Phillips is back on the schedule. We have Heisner and Brankus back, and we have
Chuck Walsh
is back on. Mm-hmm. And of course on the we have June 22nd, we have, or June 29th, we have Henry Park in the studio with us. So it's gotta agree a great year. The rest of the year is going to be awesome.
Two years
oh, next week.
My goodness.
2 years next week. Well, we want to thank you for listening to our little show, and we hope you have a wonderful week. And another Thursday night is coming up next week, and we'll be with you then. Until then, this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block, and we are out of here.